Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today we'll be taking a look at three issues in our international education news feeds that we've seen over the past 7 days, and we'll be putting our own spin on what these might mean for international education operations here in the United States. And we'll also take a look at how ways that you can get engaged with us here at SMIE Consulting. For those of you who are new to the Midweek Roundup, this is our Wednesday edition every week where we take a look at three top news stories in our international education industry. And what we do each week is look at these three issues and see how they might be impacting your campuses, how other countries are potentially dealing with international education news, and also opportunities for maybe adjusting your international education strategies to make them more appropriate for your target audiences and getting in front of your target audiences in a more engaging way. So we talk about all that here on the Roundup each week, but wanted to start first with a reminder for where these news stories that we cover each week come from. Each week I produce a newsletter that appears Monday morning about 9 o'clock. It can be delivered free of charge to your email inbox, and it's an opportunity to see what the top issues in our field are in international education as well as social media and how that impacts higher education and recruitment, student recruitment in particular. So I take a look at those and deliver that each week on Mondays through research that I do on my own each week. And then we take three of those stories from the newsletter, which is called All the SMIE News Fit to Share. And we share that with you on three of those news stories on Wednesday during the Midweek Roundup. I also want to give a special shout out to those of you who have been subscribing to our Midweek Roundup podcast, the audio version of what you're hearing here. And it's great through iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, whatever your favorite provider. You can get this from directly from your favorite podcast source. So that's another way to just listen while you work or listen while you're on a run, whatever it might be. So thanks again for subscribing for those of you who are on the podcast feed. And those watching live, obviously, great to have you with us today. And Rosanna and Bridget, glad you could be on board with us today. Hope you're doing well. And we're going to start first with one of the stories that just doesn't want to seem to go away. And this has to do with obviously the very political situation happening now between Iran and the United States regarding Iran's role in Iraq and as a destabilizing influence throughout the region through its support of terrorist organizations and obviously the killing of Soleimani three weeks ago now. But this has been a larger issue, I think, as it impacts international education. We're talking about primarily student visas here. We all know that day after the immigration of President Trump in 2017, the travel bans were introduced that included Iran and other countries. Since that time, there have been exemptions carved out in those travel bans that allow student visa applicants to still apply for visas at U.S. embassies abroad and come to the United States for study from each of those countries that were on the original visa ban list or travel ban list. And one of those countries that never seems to get a fair shake, at least as this process has gone along, is Iran for students that have traditionally wanted to come to the United States for study, primarily at the postgraduate level. They have been a demographic that for years have been challenged in terms of the smoothness of their visa process. Obviously, the most significant reason is, which we talked about last week, is that there are only three embassies, and right now only two, for Iranians living in Iran to apply for U.S. visas, since we haven't had an embassy in Tehran since 1980. So that is a challenge, obviously, that only Yerevan, Armenia, Dubai in the Emirates, and Ankara in Turkey have been available, or are available, designated as embassies for students living in Iran to apply for student visas. With Yerevan closing indefinitely to Iranian applicants, then we're just leaving two. But this is a challenge that's gone on for many months, many years. But it's intensified certainly with since President Trump took office, primarily because you look at what happens here. Iranian students are technically still allowed to apply for visas, and they are still being granted visas, though the process has been extended dramatically from a normal 2 to 3 weeks to 12 months in many cases, where the delays have been so extensive that it's really led to a lot of Iranians who might have ordinarily considered the United States giving up because it's just too darn hard now. And part of the challenge here is for Iranian students that might be looking at the United States is, yes, they can still apply and receive a student visa. Yes, it is going to take a heck of a lot longer to get that visa. But that doesn't mean they're still going to get in, they're going to be able to get into the United States. And we saw this most explicitly last summer with a group of Iranian students that were going to be attending schools on the West Coast. A group of doctoral students that were going to be coming for study for the first time, had just gotten their visas, had been waiting forever to get those visas and eventually enroll in the United States. And there was a real challenge here for them that they finally got their visas. They're getting on their plane. They're coming to start their studies, and they get put in secondary evaluation at the airport by Customs and Border Patrol, and eventually turned around and sent home. There were even stories of Iranians that were coming for study that were at the transit airports on their way to the United States, on their connecting flight to the U.S., and they were told by Customs and Border Patrol official that does go to other major destination or points of origin airports that are coming to the U.S. for that they do that. They've done that in Amsterdam for a number of years through Schiphol. But they do this in many countries around the world. They were telling Iranians that were students that had valid visas that they would not be allowed into the United States. And it just, there's such a disconnect. And this is what my main point here is. I'm posting some links to these stories. We've just also seen another one of a student that was just about to arrive, had arrived to begin studies at Northeastern University. Has now been deported. He had valid visa and everything to begin his studies. There was actually ACLU got involved, and they got a stay of the student's deportation while he was in secondary at the airport. That stay was granted, but CBP put him on a plane a half an hour later and sent him back home. So we really see some disconnects here. And when you think about how the length of the process these Iranian students have gone through to just get their visa in the first place, you see that they wait months to finally get the interview and get the good news eventually that they have been granted a visa. They get their plane ticket. They're getting on the plane, about to connect to another airport, come to the U.S., arrive in the U.S., and then Customs and Border Patrol decides no. And that's the problem here. The reasons why they never will release, because they don't talk about individual cases, why they deported a particular person. It only comes out only from firsthand accounts from the students as to why they think they were told there were issues with their entry into the United States. But you think about it, these students were interviewed at embassies and consulates around the world by our U.S. consul officer. Then as part of their evaluation, before they were granted their visa, the months-long process, they had to wait because there were all these security checks. And it's very similar to what happened post 9/11, that delays would be happening 3, 6, 12 months for visa applicants from certain Muslim countries. That process is happening again. It's slowed down dramatically, particularly for Iranian students. And that is something that I don't know if it's to be expected, but it's certainly been the reality. But they finally get those visas. What you didn't have happen in post 9/11 is stories of these students. Yes, there were students that came into secondary, but you weren't seeing these mass waves of students coming in, 12, 24, 60 for this past January term, that were trying to enter the United States, had all the right paperwork, had gone through all the security clearances, and were turned away. That didn't happen back in the same kind of numbers that we're seeing now, particularly with Iran. So this is my real disconnect for the week, and it's been one that's been there under the surface for a long time. But how is it possible, and what evidence is there to support and give the ability for a Customs and Border Patrol officer, an individual Customs and Border Patrol officer and any supervisors that might be involved, the ability to undo the work that's been done, that's taken months? Just the visa process alone has taken months for these students, the security checks that they've gone through. How all of a sudden, just based on that individual Border Patrol officer, is there an automatic undoing of all that good work, all that lengthy work, the perseverance that the student had to have to get through all that, their family and everybody that's supporting them? So for me, this is a real challenge. There's a huge disconnect between DHS and State Department when it comes to Iran now, and there's always been that, but it's really exacerbated in the current situation with Iran. So where Customs and Border Patrol issues are probably red flagging every Iranian that comes to the border, whether they're new or returning, they're almost all automatically getting secondary and really based on making decisions that we will never know about, that are based on their own personal impressions. And it's rarely ever the case that that we're seeing the whole story, obviously, but the news reports are not good. The student that was going to Northeastern who was deported and sent home, even though a judge did step in and block the deportation, he was still deported by CBP. There were a group of Iranians returning to the United States, 60 or so that were returning, coming back into from Canada, that were turned away. So there's really some major challenges we're having here, and it's certainly one that I think that we really want to really want to make sure our elected officials know about, and certainly that as you think about this, what the implications are for what we do in international education. I just encourage you all to take a look at what you can be doing to help support your students in a more cohesive way and a more practical way through advocating through your elected officials, and certainly lacking that, through your administration at your institutions, to then take the message forward to their through their channels as well. So that's really what I wanted to start with. It's a sticking point for a lot of us I know who have been in international ed for years, about how that happens. Yes, State Department grants the visas, and CBP has the right to admit or not admit the student to the country at the border. But the reality is, on the ground, when you see spikes, any spikes that are out of the ordinary and are certainly targeted towards one country, you have to think that there's something much larger at work here. And certainly undoing all the good work that's been done for a student to get to that point, particularly those from Iran who have had to wait months for their visas, that were granted, where they did clear all the security checks, yet a Customs and Border Patrol official has that right to say, nope, sorry, you're going home, without really taking into account everything else that's has made up that student's journey to get to the United States. So obviously not a pleasant situation, not a pleasant topic to talk about, but certainly one that is going to be with us for the foreseeable future, I'm afraid. Now, next up, we're going to take a turn to the UK, and we'll look at their version of Open Doors through the Higher Education Statistics Administration, or Agency, excuse me, HESA. They released the data for the 2018-19 academic year, much like Open Doors does in November each year for the previous academic year. HESA comes out in January. They revealed that international student numbers are up almost 6% on the previous year. From up to 485,645 international students were in higher education institutions in the UK in the 2018-19 academic year. So that's a jump of about 27,000 in year-on-year numbers. The news is good all the way around, frankly, for these numbers for the UK, even in the wake of Brexit that's finally going to happen at the end of the month here, at least the initial separation. A lot of the details in terms of how that impacts academic exchanges and such are still to be determined. We'll obviously be covering that here on the roundup as well. But the numbers for this past year certainly reflect increases in non-EU students coming to the UK. Also increases in EU students, first-time EU students coming to the UK. So non-EU students make up non-EU students of the 485,000, 342,000 roughly are non-EU. So well over, or just about three quarters are non-EU students studying in UK universities. Of those non-EU students at British universities, we are looking now at a third, fully a third, are from China. Overall, China represents about a quarter of the total international student population in the UK, but as it impacts non-EU students, they are a third, fully a third of that. But the biggest jumps were actually for students coming from India. You saw the second top sending country after China. They had jumps, overall jumps, from 18,325 to 26,685, so an increase of just about over 8,000. And that included 17,760 new student enrollments. And that's a 42% jump in a year for new Indian students coming to the UK. So that is driven, and many experts, and certainly those in the UK will back this up, feel that this is entirely down to the 2-year home residency, or excuse me, 2-year post-study work visa reintroduction that made it possible for students to have that 2 years of work permission after they finish their studies. So that's certainly driven a lot of interest, expanded interest in the UK, even in the wake of Brexit, which has never really been about non-EU students. It's really been about the impact on EU students, which are about a quarter of the total enrolled in the UK. So what does that mean moving forward for EU? The first article I have posted the link, as I do all the articles we talk about here, is from the Pi News, one of my favorite resources for international education news. The second is from The Guardian in the UK, where they focus on a third of non-EU students coming from China. That's 120,000 Chinese students enrolled at British universities right now. So roughly a quarter of the total in international student enrolled. So those HESA stats in the UK certainly are interesting when you put that in context of the US. But you look at the differences when we look at the Pi News story. They focus on a much broader perspective. They also, in the Guardian story, take a look at the specifics on the domestic side as well, on the total enrollments at UK universities. You now see, just anecdotally, you might want to know that the largest institution size-wise for physical campuses is University of Manchester, or excuse me, University College London, which overtook the University of Manchester at 41,000 students enrolled in degree courses, compared to Manchester's 40,000. Open University, the online largest provider of higher education, had over 122,000. But again, that's a good number of online students, as all online as part of that institution. So British numbers are going up. Even though Brexit was supposed to be this harbinger of doom for the UK and higher education there a few years ago. And we certainly will have yet to see the full impact of that as it impacts EU students. Non-EU students certainly are more driven by factors outside of Brexit, particularly those that, with the reintroduction of the 2-year post-study work visa, are really what will drive non-EU interest in Britain. But you figure now that EU students would also, though they won't have the full rights as any EU citizen had in England for work permission before Brexit, they certainly minimally would be able to avail themselves, if nothing else changes, avail themselves of the post-study work visa option. So it won't be quite as robust as what they had under the EU when Britain was a part of the EU, but certainly certainly something to keep an eye on as things move forward. But good news in England in terms of their and the UK and as a whole for their international student enrollments. So we'll turn finally to a topic, and I have it listed here as the Save OPT campaign, a hashtag campaign. I don't know if I'm starting it or not, but certainly those in international ed circles certainly know of the pending lawsuit that's making its way up through the courts in the U.S. That is a challenge to OPT and its legal its ability to exist as a benefit for international students, the work permission that they have. So there have also been talks about how the current administration's attempts to cut back on international students, though that's never been said outright. Certainly, there's the undercurrents in the anti-immigration language of the administration that certainly gets a lot of press about what that might mean as it impacts future international student enrollments. But what we're talking about here is President Trump's plan regarding improved STEM education in the United States. And we all know in international ed circles, STEM is, particularly STEM OPT, is one of the most significant draws for international students, aside from the quality of U.S. institutions, is certainly one of the differentiators that has in past been a real attractive magnet for the United States, for international students to come and study STEM programs in U.S. fields, because they get potentially three years of work permission for each degree level that they obtain here. President Trump has come in with a plan since his inauguration 3 years ago now to improve STEM education in the U.S. As invested $540 million in the latest fiscal year towards that end. It's a five-year plan the president rolled out to make quality STEM more accessible for Americans. There are challenges, though, in the system, the way it's set up in the United States now, because as many in graduate education in international ed circles know, many STEM fields would not, departments would not exist at the graduate level if it were not for international students. For example, there's one example in the story I've just posted that the University of Florida in their computer science department, 95% of their graduates in 2015 were international, and that's numbers about the same over the last few years. So there are many departments that would be 65-70% international in engineering fields, in computer science, mathematics fields. One of the reasons the lawsuits have been moving forward is critics argue that foreign students impede U.S. educational opportunities, according to the article, by competing with American students for a limited number of seats. And the research, certainly by an economist, Kevin Shee, has revealed that it might be true for private universities, but the effect is really negligible. His remarks are not statistically different from zero. I guess it isn't really true there. But when he looked at public universities, the research Kevin Shee has produced finds that on average, an increase of 10 international students in a STEM department leads to the enrollment of 8 additional American students. So why does that happen? Well, we know about the differentials in tuition rates for international versus domestic. And the argument here is these international students, the pay that they are contributing is that, for, say, in the UC system, roughly one-third of the funding for international graduate students goes toward funding for lower income American students. So as a way to help fund positions for those that have a need to pursue or a desire to pursue STEM fields but don't have the financial resources. That's a way that a lot of state institutions are able to help pay the costs of education for domestic students. So frankly, the international students, as we know in the field, certainly are vital to American STEM education. And if policies are introduced to turn them away, to reduce the attractiveness of the United States and potential work opportunities after graduation, those are going to be serious challenges to our continued success in international student recruitment. So it's really something we want to keep our eyes on, and certainly we'll look at the impacts any legal battles have on STEM education in the United States. Now, I'll finish up today with a report, and I want to finish on a positive, where we always like to focus on those success stories out there. We look back at look back at my time working for Education USA at the State Department, where one of the guiding mantras about why international students coming to the United States, sending U.S. students abroad, is a public diplomacy tool. It's a way to help demystify what the United States is all about. From our citizens going and studying abroad to interact with people in those countries so they get a better understanding of who Americans are, and our American students who study overseas get a better appreciation for the world around them. Same goes for those international students that come here. They are familiar with, before they come, if they haven't had any exposure to us, they know the U.S. based on what they see on TV and in the media, in their own media. And the reality is something dramatically different for many of them as they, when they first start their studies here. Every student I interview about after their exposure, after an orientation program started, and while they're still excited, I say, hey, what are you most surprised about after your first few days and weeks here in the U.S.? And to a person, they would always say, it's not anything like what I saw on TV back home. And that's the reality. And that when the students that come to the United States and experience our colleges and universities, interact with our local communities, they get an appreciation far and above anything that they might see in the media and on TV. They get an appreciation for who we are as a people, what our culture is about, and how we are in reality, not what they've seen on TV. And this last link I posted here is from an Indian, now Indian American, who came to the U.S. 23 years ago as a college graduate from Delhi. He got his visa, and as he says, that changed my life forever. He did a computer science master's program at the University of Denver. Shout out to Marjorie Smith and the folks there at Denver. His thought was that an American education coupled with postgraduate work in the States would prepare him for any career back home. That was the goal, but he never left. As he turned out, he went through his year of practical training time at that point, and then the company hired him on a full-time basis on an H visa. He became a chief technology officer at a company, and has since become a serial entrepreneur in the U.S. and has created hundreds of jobs for Americans as a result of his studying here. And that is the lawsuit that we mentioned earlier to restrict OPT is something he says it would be a disaster if this went through. He makes the case much like that previous article I referenced. President Trump says he wants to put American companies first, but killing OPT would do the opposite. The direct cost of ending the program would total over $130 million, according to New American Economy, and it would worsen an already substantial worker shortage in the STEM fields. In 2015, Colorado had 15 STEM jobs posted online for each unemployed STEM worker, according to Burning Glass Technologies. Finally, it would help our competitors as foreign graduates take their American knowledge and skills to other countries. And that's something we can't ignore. We're in a globally competitive market for international students to begin with. By putting up roadblocks and turning students away, we would be losing our best and brightest, future best and brightest, from ever even entering or considering coming to the United States. So I really, really think there's a lot of value here that we certainly don't want to ignore in terms of what's coming down the pike here. for STEM OPT and changes to OPT, H-1B. All of that's going to be vitally important that we're still keeping our eyes on the ball here. But definitely want to make sure you're aware of what some of the core issues are that are impacting what we do, as I'm sure you're aware, and how we can take it to the next level with our advocacy. So thanks again for joining us today on this week's Midweek Roundup, and we're looking forward to getting in touch with you again next week. Have a great time. Have a great day. Cheers.